Oh, that's a cool sound, isn't it? Thanks for spending some of your day with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great time of the year for amphibian activity, and we're going to talk about how to identify some of our frogs and toads and salamanders, and we have two guests for you. Katie Belfis, one of them. She's the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Katie, welcome back.
Great to see you. Great to hear you. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, great to see you. Gary Casper, our other guest, is the owner of Great Lakes Ecological Services. He's an associate scientist with the UW-Milwaukee Field Station and an adjunct of the graduate faculty at UW-Green Bay. And Gary, welcome to you.
Well, hi, Larry. Hi, Katie. Happy spring.
Happy spring to you. As you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Do you need help identifying an amphibian? Are you seeing some salamanders these days? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Gary, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about the work you do with amphibians.
Well, I've been studying amphibians for several decades, but probably one of the biggest things has been helping the National Park Service set up a monitoring program, which was what started this field guide production.
I tell you what, this field guide that I have in front of me is fabulous. Katie, tell us about the new guide the Wisconsin Wetlands Association has helped to create.
Yeah, we were super excited to be invited by Gary, who with his colleagues produced this beautiful guide. And as you know, we're a statewide nonprofit conservation organization, and we work all across Wisconsin to help people and communities care for wetlands. And one of the things we really want to do is connect people with information to better understand and enjoy the wetlands around them. And so when Gary reached out to us to tell us about this publication, we said, sign us up. It sounds like a great thing. And I tell you, they've been flying off the shelves to our audience.
I can see why. They're just wonderful. Maybe just describe... I thought that the photos of the egg masses in particular was really cool because there are so many in many different shapes, and you come on one of these in the field, and you know, if you don't know anything, good to have a guide like this.
Indeed, and the photography is really beautiful. You know, I am not an amphibian expert. I'm the audience perhaps for this book, because I'm the one out there looking at things trying to figure out what the heck is going on, and I felt it was, you know, there's a lot of good technical information, but as you say, the photos and the keys, the little guides that help you determine what you're looking at, are also very accessible to people who are interested in this kind of stuff and wanting to learn more.
Well, it's really cool. Gary, how many types of frogs and toads and salamanders do we have in the state?
Well, there's only about a dozen, so it's not that hard to learn how to identify most of them. The biggest challenge for producing this book was finding pictures of all these life stages, though. I mean, I've taken a lot of them myself over the years, but getting good pictures of small things is not always easy, especially when you're in the field. So we did manage to round up a whole bunch of photographers to contribute to this book. And every species, there's full color photos of all the variation in the egg masses, in the tadpoles, and pictures of adults as well.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. I'm going to hang on to my copy for sure, and it's easy enough to carry around in the field as well. Somebody asked me the other day, what's the difference between a frog and a toad? And I think I answered it, but I think you could probably, Gary, do a better job of it. Go ahead.
Well, toads are frogs. They're all in the same family. Toads are just a distinct genus, and they're typified as having warty skin and living more on land than in water for most of their life cycle.
Yeah, and we have some... species of amphibians threatened or endangered in the state, do we not?
We do. In particular, the Blanchard's cricket frog is listed as endangered, and that's declined substantially since historic times. And then there's a couple other amphibians that are listed as special concern. So maybe we don't have the greatest data on their distribution and status, but they're felt to be declining or at least at risk. So some of those might be the pickerel frog and the four-toed salamander.
So a couple there. Charles in Blair, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there. Charles, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for answering my call. I have a pond, and every year I hear a succession of four different types of frogs. First, there's the regular frogs and the peepers, then the tree frogs, and then in June, I think they're frogs, but I don't know. There's these four spots by my pond where these frogs, they go boop, 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 and it's always only four of them, and they're not in the pond. They're somewhere off the pond, and there's always four of them. They're always in exactly the same spot, and I don't know what they are. I've never seen them.
Hmm. Well, Gary, what do you think?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. The description of the sound it seems similar to green frogs, but the behavior doesn't. So it's hard to say without actually hearing an example of the sound.
Charles, you're going to have to turn your phone on record and record that sound. There are places where you can go to identify those, are there not, Gary? You know, where you can say, hey, what the various sounds of a bullfrog or whatever.
There are, and there's also a wonderful app for a smartphone called Herp Mapper. And if you install that and sign up for a free account, then when you hear this frog, you can just start the app and it'll ask you if you want to take a picture or record the sound. And then you can just record the sound and then upload that record. And after a time, other people will start looking at it and reviewing it and let you know their opinion on what it is.
Very cool. Charles, you're also going to have to get a copy of this field guide. By the way, how do we get a copy of this field guide? It's called Field Guide to Amphibian Eggs and Larvae of the Western Great Lakes. And how do we get copies of it?
You can get this publication either through the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. We have it for sale on our website, wisconsinwetlands.org. You can also purchase it from the Midwest Partners in Amphibian and Reptile Conservation from their website as well. And I'll make sure that your producer has that information to post those links for your listeners.
Yeah. And what's the cost on it?
It's $25 plus shipping.
$25 plus shipping. And
and
a good
one of
deal
the cool things about the guide, Larry, is that it's waterproof. Gary and his friend, co-publishers did a wonderful job of designing the publication so that you know, these are all wet places we're walking around in trying to find these eggs and larvae. So the book itself is waterproof. The paper that it's on is printed on waterproof paper. So you can drop it right in there and it's going to keep on ticking.
And I see we have a link on our program notes, too. So if you go to WPR.org/Larry, you may be accustomed to doing that. And go to our program, today's program, and go to our program notes, and you'll see it right there, the link to how to get a copy. I'm just trying to read. Robert called to say that sound is, he thinks that sound is a carp. It sounds fishy to me. All right, there we go. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I like that, ideas@wpr.org, or again, 1-800-642-1234. When can we expect to see eggs and larvae in ponds?
Oh, right now. I would say that about a quarter of our amphibian species have already laid their eggs. So now is a great time to go into the pond and look for eggs. And then, of course, once those eggs hatch, the tadpoles and the salamander larvae will be in there, well into June, early July.
And again, those great photos available in the booklet itself or the guide itself. If you see a tadpole or a larvae, you should be able to identify it by a quick look through the book. So that's pretty cool. Well, sort of a general or maybe an overall question for you both. What place do amphibians have in the ecosystem, and why are they so important? And Gary, we'll start with you.
Okay, big question. So amphibians are interesting because they require multiple habitats to complete their life cycle, which is kind of the definition of an amphibian. So they often will breed in wetlands and then spend the rest of their life on land. So what that means is they need to have multiple habitats available in order to live out their lives in a viable fashion. So people who are interested in preserving our habitats and our biodiversity kind of key in on this as a focal species that indicates that the landscape is actually intact and functioning with connections between the wetlands and the uplands. And one of the reasons we wanted to get this guide out to the public was because a lot of people study wetlands and a lot of educators use wetlands to introduce students to nature. And not a lot of people were very good at identifying these early life stages of amphibians. But it's often real important to understand what amphibians are in the wetland, because that's an indicator of how well you're doing on preserving the habitats. So all these amphibians, not only are there indicators that way, but they're also really playing a key role in producing food for the whole food chain. So amphibians are both at the top and the bottom of these food chains. They produce a lot of tadpoles. Most of them get eaten. Most of those tadpoles who actually do make it out of the pond and hop into the woods get eaten as well by things like hawks and snakes and weasels and all sorts of other birds and mammals. Even fish will be eating these. But then once they do make it to adulthood, those amphibians are feeding on insects. And also, as larvae, they'll feed on insects, and they really love mosquito larvae to feed on. So they play all these multiple roles in the system, and they have really interesting life history, and most people just like frogs.
Yeah.
What's not to like about frogs, I let us say? What's not to like?
And Katie, it's obvious the Wetlands Association would have a strong interest in this as well.
For sure. And, you know, one of the things, a lot of the frogs and the salamanders rely on, we say the word pond, but in many cases it's ephemeral ponds that are very shallow on the landscape and don't persist as wet areas throughout the year. They're wet in the spring and early summer, and many of them dry out by late summer, fall. So sometimes these areas are overlooked on the landscape and people don't think about them as being wetlands, but they are, and they're super important to our amphibians as we've been discussing here. So we love using frogs as a way to get people seeing these places on the landscape, hearing them on the landscape, and thinking about them as wetlands.
We have some callers online, and we'll get to Sherry and others in just a moment. Just a reminder, we're talking about amphibians and this great new guide, field guide to amphibian eggs and larvae of the Western Great Lakes with our two guests today, Katie Belfis of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Gary Casper, who is the owner of Great Lakes Ecological Services. He's also an associate scientist with UW-Milwaukee Field Station and an adjunct of the grad faculty at UW-Green Bay. And also Jill Nadeau, who is our producer, and Christina Myshock, our engineer. And I am Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking amphibians today and the new field guide about amphibians that you should get your hands on with our two guests, Katie Belfis and Gary Casper. Join in with questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Sherry in Superior now. Sherry, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
When I was growing up, we would occasionally catch these little ugly things with legs and fluffy gills. My dad always called them mud puppies. Then in later years, I saw when they sold bait at the shops, they had things that looked a lot like them, but they were really colorful. They called those water dogs. Are these amphibians? Are both of them native to Wisconsin, or and do they ever live on land?
Okay, Gary.
Sure. So the answers to your questions are mostly yes. Mud puppies are a real thing, and they are, as you described, with the bushy gills and four little stubby legs, and they're totally aquatic. They never come out of the water. One caveat, though, a lot of people who see tiger salamander larvae think that they're mud puppies. So if you're finding these larvae in temporary ponds that are not permanent, it's possible you're seeing tiger salamander larvae instead of mud puppies. Now, as regards the bait stores, water dogs are another real thing. And as you described, they do have the bushy external gills and a much slimmer body than a mud puppy. But sometimes they do contaminate bait minnow supplies. So they would be coming up from down south. They're not native to Wisconsin.
I have a mud puppy lure. Of course, it's not a live mud puppy. It's one made out of plastic. And I've used that for fishing on occasion. But I have to say I've never had much luck with it. I don't know if the fish like to eat them or not. But the mud puppy bait was good at catching a fisherman, at least me and probably a lot of other people as well. Sherry, there you go. Thank you so much. You can join in 800-642-1234. Eric in Oneida County, your turn. Thanks for calling, Eric.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. I'm with the Oneida County Clean Water Action Group, and up here we tend to monitor metallic sulfide mining drilling sites, and many of these have been in wetland areas. And I'm just wondering if the experts, if there's some kind of, are there frogs that are protected, and is there any consideration on the amphibians when it comes to, designating areas, safer amphibians, and are certain ones protected or not?
Hmm. Gary, you want to start out here?
Okay. So as far as protection goes, there's only the one species that's listed, the cricket frog, which does not occur in Oneida County. The other species that might be special concern, while there is concern about them, there's no regulatory requirement to protect them. So mostly the function of amphibians in trying to protect wetlands in a regulatory sense is just discovering what's there, whether the wetland is supporting a diverse community, and making the argument that whatever the action is that may be insulting this community is not in the best interest.
Katie, anything to add there?
Well, no, not particularly. I think that's right. They often are just sort of indicators of the presence of wetlands, and so that's a good way to sort of find them on the landscape, particularly when they might be dry at other times of the year and might not look like wetlands at other times of the year. It's a little bit tricky to comment on Wisconsin's regulations for wetlands because they have changed in recent years and are where they used to sort of be blanket across the state. Now that they vary depending on how close to an urban area the development proposal is. And so it's hard to speak about regulations in a particular space without knowing the details of the context.
Okay. Eric, thanks for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give us a call. Or you can email, in fact, a listener email. They have a small koi pond and have taken out two dead toads. They look like they drowned since they were at the bottom and bloated. They thought they could hold their breath. Any idea as to how this could happen?
Gary, I'm hoping you can chime in on
all,
that one.
We're all thinking about this. Gary, what do you think?
Yeah, if it's in a fish pond like that, my first suspicion would be that the fish pulled them under and injured them enough, but then spit them out because they were distasteful. Those warts on the toads actually contain a very distasteful poison. So anyone who's seen like a dog bite a toad might have seen this reaction where the dog will drop it and then it'll start rubbing his muzzle on the grass, trying to wipe it off and maybe salivating a lot. So toads are kind of protected that way, but if the predator doesn't know beforehand that they taste bad, they still might injure them enough to kill them, and then you could find some dead ones.
All right, there we go. That makes sense to me. Well, Katie, sort of a general thing about wetlands. We haven't had a lot of rain in or much at all in some parts of the state in particular. How's this affecting our wetlands, you know?
Well, you know, it depends on the kind of wetland that you're talking about. Certainly water levels are lower than they might be this time of year in a lot of places because, as you say, it has been quite dry. So there might be areas that are shallower and maybe don't have as much water this year. So for the amphibians that might have bred there, it might be tougher if they don't have as much water. But variations in water cycles are a natural part of our systems, right? And it's challenging for individuals, but it's a part of nature that there are drier years and wetter years. And the challenge being, of course, that in old days, we had more wetlands and more open landscapes. And so critters had more places to go to. If their particular little pond wasn't working out for them, they could go somewhere else. And now we have more development on the land, and it's harder for species to find the next place if their place dries up. So it does pose a challenge, but it is part of nature. And lots of times, you know, people talk about wetlands needing to be wet, but it's actually very important for a lot of different kinds of wetlands to dry down periodically. It's actually part of what keeps them healthy. So a little bit of natural variation and ebb and flow of water cycles can be pretty good.
Let's take another call. You know, Jeff. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gary.
I was going to add to that in a dry year like this, it tends to concentrate the amphibians into the remaining water areas. So it's all that much easier to go out there with this guide and find their eggs.
there's the silver lining, huh?
There's the silver. So the populations are going to ebb and flow then, Gary. The amphibian, you know, you get a dry spring, it's going to make a difference.
Absolutely. And most amphibians have really high reproductive potential, so they can bounce back from drought years pretty quickly.
Yeah. Jeff in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hi. Talking about that koi pond, we have a pond in our backyard that the wildlife like a lot. We always had a toad that would come every year. But one year, I realized that I didn't have a way out of that pond. It's the plastic you know, little koi ponds that they sell at the stores. And I contributed it to the toad not being able to get out because of the plastic. So from that year on, I've always made rocks to one side for when they did show up, that they had a way to get out without drowning. It's just what I found out.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Jeff, yeah, that's a great idea. Jeff, what about our, I'm sorry, what about, Gary, those ponds? I mean, I think even those small ponds, remember Scott Craven, you know, they always had a small pond at their place, Scott and Candy Craven, and invariably there were frogs in there almost by magic, because it felt like there was no other where. How did they even get there? You wonder sometimes, how the heck did they even get to a place like that? I was thinking of Scott's home, where he was in a pretty, at that time, was in a very urban area, and somehow they were, the frogs found it.
Yeah, sometimes it's amazing how fast they can colonize a new pond. And so, you know, several species in Wisconsin are just marvelous at exploiting these things, including, you know, these backyard koi ponds, and toads are one of them. They'll find them quickly, and they'll use them if they can. But other species of amphibians have very particular requirements about the habitat they want. So they need specialized types of wetlands, like, for example, four-toed salamanders that lay their eggs within moss.
Yeah, that makes that does make sense. Mark and Kimberly, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
First, question about land acquisition, if the Nature Conservancy is working with your coalition a lot, if they've got a map of their targets, what's preserved, what needs to be. And then second is comment, I was trucking in 2015 through 17 down south, and in states like Alabama, Georgia, and North Carolina, you'd hear these tree frogs, and it was amazing. And at 1 a.m., as if you flipped a switch, they'd all start in, just like spring peepers up here at their peak, and they'd roar on and on into the night. And then, you know, I heard that in 2015, 16, and then 2017, not so much, and things went silent. And so that's what I'm so concerned about. You know, in Costa Rica, the first species documented to go down from climate change was, I guess, the golden toad in Costa Rica. And like you say, this has got a partial dry land life cycle. It depended on the winds being right, the air movements, the meteorology, it was the fog that condensed off the trees that formed these little ponds that gave the breeding spot, little puddles, for the golden toads. And when the climate changed, extinct. And they were beautiful, beautiful, like all yellow-orange looking body, and just horrible thing. And amphibians in general, if you could talk, you know, a little about U.S. and internationally, the whole thing. That's all.
All right, Mark, thanks. Gary, some comments.
Okay, yeah, I'm familiar with the golden toad story, and it is tragic. But one thing to keep in mind is that in the tropics, things are different. A lot of those amphibians are highly specialized to particular niches, and then they're more sensitive to things like climate change and disease than the amphibian community up here in Wisconsin is. So a lot of people don't keep in mind the deep history of Wisconsin, which is not very old. All of the amphibians here have only been here for a few thousand years, maybe 5,000 years or so, because prior to that, it was all under ice. So the amphibian community that we have here now has not really evolved to be very specialized. They're mostly generalists. so they're not quite as sensitive to these insults. But that said, they still are, of course, sensitive to losing their habitat and to the diseases that are coming in with climate change as well. There's been some pretty serious diseases that are spreading among amphibians. They don't seem to be terribly prevalent in Wisconsin, at least not yet. But they are wiping out populations all over the world, really. So there's a lot of concern about amphibians right now, or at least recently. The Wisconsin climate seems to be getting warmer and wetter, which ironically will probably favor most amphibians, at least in the short term.
I have one follow-up comment there that takes us a little bit away from amphibians, but is still related to the habitat and to the gentleman's question about climate change. And just to point out that a lot of these same habitats that are great for salamanders and amphibian and frogs and toads and such for reproduction are also the same wetlands that will be the most helpful to us in many ways with the greater rain events and the warmer temperatures, because they're often very small but very numerous on the landscape, and they absorb a lot of the water, the precipitation, the snow melt, and hold that water so that it doesn't go whooshing down the streams and rivers and causing lots of erosion and other challenges, but really holds the water on the landscape to help buffer our communities from some of the challenges that we'll see from climate change.
Interesting. Mark, thanks again for those comments. Scott in Madison, what's on your mind?
Morning. I last year saw what I believe was a cricket frog in town on the sidewalk. I ended up chasing it off trying to catch it. And how prevalent are they in inner cities?
Well, what do you think, Gary?
Yeah, because I'm doing this interview in between my cricket frog trip to the Twin Cities, where we discovered cricket frogs living in the industrial backwaters just downstream of the city of St. Paul. So this was surprising to a lot of people that cricket frogs can survive in such, you know, urbanized and industrialized environments. But they are. You know, that doesn't mean they're not still sensitive to habitat loss, because the habitat's still there. It's just very noisy, very busy, and often heavily polluted region. So cricket frogs recently seem to be expanding their range again, and we think that's because of climate change. They are a southern species. They reach their northern range limit in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And as the winters get milder and milder, the cricket frogs can survive the winters better. Now, I have never heard of any in the in Madison or around Madison, but they're not too far away.
Another good role for that HurtMapper app, Gary. Maybe we can Scott can take a picture next time he sees what he thinks is a cricket frog and send that in, so we can help him out and know if it is a cricket frog.
Yeah, there you go, Scott. Thank you. Kathy in LaGrange, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Hi, Larry, longtime listener, big fan. Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting program. Hi, Katie and Gary. I'm calling because I have property that borders protected wetland, and I have a hot tub with a cover, but still, I get frogs and toads that manage to get inside my hot tub and invariably lose their lives, and it makes me very sad. So I'm wondering if there's something I can do to protect them from getting underneath that cover and then getting in the hot tub.
Huh. Gary, has that ever come up? I mean, with a cover, you'd think the cover would be... I mean, they're heavy. They tend to be fairly heavy.
Yeah. Obviously, it's just not tight enough, and they're able to squeeze through. So you'd probably have to find what cracks they're squeezing through and seal them up. Some frogs, like especially tree frogs, are just notorious for getting into things, even shorting out power lines. One morning, I found a tree frog had decided to go into my boot, which I had left out to dry overnight. And then I put it on, and after I drive a couple miles, I'm feeling something move around my toes. And they take my boot off, and sure enough, it's a tree frog. So, you know, they get into things. That's what frogs do.
Oh, man. Kathy, thanks a lot for calling. Denise emailed that if you're concerned about frogs in particular, it's wise to rid your property of buckthorn. Buckthorn emits a chemical called emidin, which is very detrimental to frog metamorphoses. This is particularly true in the spring during melting and load periods. Gary, are you familiar with that?
I am. There's Professor Roberto Brenes at Carroll College in Waukesha that's been studying this. And yeah, there's a chemical that leaches out of the buckthorn. It can flush into the wetlands in the spring, or especially if people are trying to control buckthorn and they're just cutting it and leaving the cuttings lay in or near the wetland. It'll leach out of those cuttings and contaminate the wetland in that manner. So Roberto has done some lab experiments that do strongly suggest that larvae and eggs exposed to high concentrations of emodin have much higher mortality rates and deformity rates. So not a good thing. Control that buckthorn, but pile the cuttings away from the wetlands.
Oh, okay. Well, Kathy, thanks. Denise, thank you so much for bringing that up. Appreciate it very much. And here we are approaching the end of the show again. Run over what we've got with this great field guide to amphibians.
Yeah, so the field guide to amphibian eggs and larvae of the Western Great Lakes is available from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and the Midwest Partners in Amphibian and Reptile Conservation. And it's a beautiful guide with lots of photos as well as a key that will help you determine, what thing you might be looking at. Some of those photos, you know, to the untrained eye look a little bit similar. So there's a nice guide that helps you walk through where are you on the landscape and what might you be looking at? What are the plausible choices to help you pick from the guide? It's a waterproof guide, and we would love to have it get into as many hands as we can, all those amphibian lovers out there.
Yeah, that's for sure. And we do have a link on in our program notes on today's show today at ideas@WPR.org/Larry. You can find the link there if you didn't get it written down. Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today, Katie and Gary. I hope we can do this again, and I hope we get a lot of those books out into the hands of our Wisconsin citizens. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry.
You're welcome. Happy frogging.
Happy Wetlands Month.
Yeah, it is American Wetlands Month. Katie Belfus is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Gary Casper is the owner of Great Lakes Ecological Services. He's also an associate scientist with the UW-Milwaukee Field Station and an adjunct of the graduate faculty at UW-Green Bay. Really fun to talk with them about amphibians and about this great guide. I'm going to hang on to mine. You should take a look and see what it looks like. You're going to want it too. Well, you're, I think, also going to want to know a little bit more about youth gardens, and that's what our topic is next. We're going to take a look at youth garden education with a couple of great guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Having to do with her life there, especially the life as forced upon.